Blog Talk Radio.
Dale Graham. It's a pleasure to have you join. Always a great opportunity to have a talk on things Masonic with brethren. Whether you can get in or out of the lodge, it really doesn't matter. We'll bring what we can to you. We'll try and be discreet about it. I think that's the only reasonable thing to do, as you all understand. It's Canada Day here in 2014, it's amazing that we are Canada celebrating in a couple of days the birth, what we call the birth of this country. It's an amazing place to live, as you all know. It represents the enactment of the British North America Act in 1867. It's a major part of our Constitution, of course. And it enacts the original creation of a federal dominion, under the government of Canada. And it has, as you know, a federal structure, House of Commons, Senate, all controversial these days, but the way we draw the number of people that are coming out to engage in their franchise, it raises some questions about what's going on. Something isn't quite the way that the founding fathers intended. So, but we're not quite sure what. We're still at the point of blame, pointing fingers. It doesn't seem to get us really very far, but it is sort of a Canadian way of expressing the fact that we're a bit annoyed, but not enough to get up off our easy chair and put down the remote. Well, that will come. If it gets to that point, things get really serious in this country. That happens when we're called to defend rights, go to war, do battle. That's when you see Canadians step up as a nation. And we just have some recent acknowledgments of things that have passed in battle. And, today is also the beginning of Ramadan for our Muslim brethren. And I'm sure that we wish them all well. It's a month of introspection, I guess you would say, acknowledgement, fasting during the day. In the histories of major religions, you see that type of what do you call it, culturally coming together. That's things that as Freemasons, we would certainly understand. It's a fasting month. And it's one of the five pillars of Islam. I think it, if I'm not mistaken, it also celebrates when the revelation of the Islamic prophet Muhammad, may peace be with him, was given to the world. Anyway, we'll go from that to celebrations and bacchanalia and expressions in Toronto of World Pride Day. It defines the country, the tolerance of the country, not individual opinion, but a tolerance the dissenting voice, an agreement to disagree, but to do it with an element of dignity and honor. People go about their business, and we acknowledge that if we can comfortably say that what happens, we respect the privacy of people. This is not crossing the line into criminal activity. So this we face on this really remarkable time. We can, I think, all stand proud of the nation and acknowledge that it doesn't come easy. It doesn't. If every one of us decided just to go over the top every time something didn't agree with our beliefs, we would quickly deteriorate into anarchy. And we see that at other places in the world, and we know what we're seeing. We shake our heads. The chaos and fear that occurs when that sense of cohesiveness and brotherhood doesn't exist. Here, we may not agree with you, but we're not necessarily going to harm you and your family, or your way of life. But I always think that it's a wonderful country because people have been coming here from other places with those strong memories of their homelands, as everybody has at one point in their history. We're a migratory type of critter. And yet when our kids strap on a pair of figure skates or skis or grab a hockey stick, our boys and girls, it's like really that blurring of where you've been. Well, your history defines who you were. But where we are today is in, we can savor the greatness of this country when we see our children playing together and cheering for their favorite teams, and whether it's on the football field or in the hockey rinks or on the tennis courts now or golf courses. It's, you know, those big sporting events pull us together. No, they're not essential perhaps to the functioning of the global economy, but it's a time of pause when we can sit together and cheer and wave and let ourselves go and become just a little bit disinhibited. Where else are you going to see stiff Canadians jumping up and down and cheering? It's a good thing. We've got an interesting show today. It's a topic I've been meaning to ask you about for quite some time. And I've been a little bit hesitant to do that because it's a bit chewy. This is one of those areas in masonry that I'm not quite sure whether it was ever front and center, you know. I'll give you an example of what I mean. I've happened across a copy of the Proceedings from 1926. I won't get into all of it, but this is from a portion where this is from 1926 when it was held, the grand annual communication was held at Fort William in Port Arthur. And I'm just reading some notes put in here by James Gill, the district deputy grand master of Hamilton District A. And And it just give you a bit of a window. I think it's kind of interesting. He talks about some observations. Oakville Lodge number 400 is to be congratulated, he says, upon the beautiful room in which the brethren meet and also upon the commodious banquet room beneath. Ancaster Lodge room has been newly decorated and now presents a pleasing aspect to the eye. An educated man, a cultured man, yeah. Perhaps he was a farmer. Waterdown Lodge, it would appear, needs a more modern and commodious assembly room. So, not critical, but making observations. In my addresses, I frequently made a comparison between the large sums spent in refreshments in the banquet room and the small sums spent on benevolence, and endeavored to show the brethren the necessity of spending more in benevolence and charity and less in refreshments. I stated in a number of lodges that benevolence did not necessarily begin and end with the widows and children of Masons, but might extend beyond the confines of Masonry and embrace such organizations as children's homes, children's shelters, sanatoria, and such like institutions. At the annual meeting of St. John's Lodge, the district chaplain gave, at my request, a short address on benevolence and charity. In the course of his address, he showed how the two differed in some respects, but were nowadays practically synonymous terms. One of his statements deserves to be recorded. I'm going to share that with you today. He said, "We very often hear the statement, as cold as charity, but you never hear as cold as benevolence." He then goes on to comment on Junior Members Night. "A practice has grown up of late years of holding special meetings at which the younger members take the working of the degrees, doing all parts with the exception of the obligation. This is very desirable and has the effect of maintaining interest, but I would offer the objection that it does not seem very appropriate that a brother who received his third degree at a meeting should, at the very next meeting, 1 month later, communicate the secrets of the degree to a candidate." He talks about entertainment at the banquet room. "This part of the lodge's activities has of late years assumed very large proportions. In order to provide talent and vary the proceedings, women are brought in to sing solos, and young boys and girls in their teens are kept waiting until between 11 and 12 o'clock to give exhibition dances. Your district deputy thinks these practices are worthy of censure and would suggest that the most worshipful, the Grand Lodge, make some ruling in the matter." You can see, why wouldn't everybody be aware that you have young people waiting around until that hour? Indifference to the anything but the purpose. Not exactly what I call a Masonic highlight here. But publicity, he says, "I am greatly indebted to the following brethren who accompanied me in different times on my visits and contributed in no small measure to the success of many of the meetings." And then he goes on to list about a dozen people. "It seems to me, your district deputy, that too much is published in the papers. Another custom that has come forward to the front of late is the habit of reporting very fully in the daily papers the proceedings of a lodge meeting as far as the officers elected, their offices, those who were present, those who addressed the brethren in the banquet room are concerned. The public does not need to be informed of the officers elected and of those who took part in the program in the banquet room or any other matter connected with the lodge." And he gives us some really interesting little pearls. A few statistics, he says. 14 lodges showed an increase in membership and 2 a decrease. 194 first degrees were confirmed, 198 seconds, and 202 thirds. It's the opposite of what it is today. The largest number initiated in any one lodge was 29, and the smallest was 2. 5 lodges showed no suspension for non-payment. 5 had no deaths among the members. And the sums given in relief ranged from nothing to $699. 2 of the lodges had no calls for relief. In closing, I must thank the district secretary for his zeal, ardor, and assistance in the work and for his wholehearted endeavors to make every meeting a success. Fraternally submitted. And there's reports from the district deputies throughout the 1926, wedged in between the wars. Gives us a sense that you judge for yourself. Have things been addressed? Are we able to talk about our issues without having at each other? You know, temper is it's the area of the work as a therapist that I specialize in. People that have difficulty with temper and aggression, irritability. Funny. Just how much those folks seem to suffer, at least in my mind. I want to talk to you about the Alchemist's Journal, but it's summer, and it's coming up to the Canada Day, and hopefully the bright, warm weather will continue to haunt us. We well deserve it in the land of ice and snow. Here's a little summary toe tapper. Check it out.
Take it to Bermuda, Bahamas, come on, pretty mama.
There we have it, brethren. Let's move on today. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the episode today. It's called The Alchemist's Journal. We see that our high-tech formulation has fallen apart a little bit, fooling around computer screens. Of course I would. We'll do better in the future. I refer to this as sort of one of those lost chapters that I wanted to talk to you about. And I entitled it The Alchemist's Journal. I started this chapter questioning if a Mason is naturally curious and wanting to discover the mysteries. But I thought better of that. Some are, most are not. It is esoteric and requires study. It's about Freemasonry. It's about asking fundamental, essential questions if you're looking for the mysteries, I think. If you hear somebody talking about enjoying the journal, I think you should run away fast. What makes us think the path to enlightenment is either fun or easy? It's like asking, did you enjoy reaching the summit of Everest? Did you enjoy reaching the beaches of Normandy? Did you enjoy sailing across the ocean? I would think that is a weak question in the face of such accomplishments. But nevertheless, it is one we often hear. Enjoying an arduous journey seems to trivialize effort required, which is what distinguishes those who do from those who do not, the adventurer from the timid. I have no idea how we respond to the moment of enlightenment. We don't, until we get there. And if you get there, would you please give me a call and let me know? What we do know is that it is a unique experience to understand. You imagine that, a point of enlightenment where we understand it all. I think most of us can agree that something deep happens when a mind sees existence for what it is. Freemasonry, it's a blend. Part ritual reenactment. Ritual lets us practice and share experience from before. It is of the past and from the past, but in the moment. We do it right now. Yet another portion takes us to the door of an alchemist's laboratory. I like that thought. Just takes us to the door. Doesn't make us go in. If we choose to make it our laboratory, we take on responsibility to proceed knowledgeably. Study, focus, attentiveness with the history of religion, of philosophy, of influences and thought, of the essential questions. If we do not understand metaphor or allegory or enigma, welcome to the human race. We are not born with such knowledge. You may be born with the capability, but it must be acquired. As we become an alchemist, just like learning a new trade or profession, we learn unfamiliar terms, just as any apprentice or learner must do. What does it mean? That's my question to you. The practice of alchemy has some very strong connections with Masonic structure and ritual. If you believe in such things, if you don't, of course they don't exist. So I think not only do I think that I was taken to the door reluctantly, I think, unsure, not naive, but told to trust by people I really didn't know. But for some odd reason, I either stumbled or followed somebody through that door or went through of my own volition. And I'm glad I did. It opened up an aspect of Freemasonry that I think removes some questions and doubts. There is no question in my mind about pulling away or not being part of this. This is essential and fundamental. It's vital. It's like life-giving. Stimulates your mind like nothing else ever has before. And I think for a lot of the listeners, it's the same way. Nothing else quite comes close to this. But there are some people who have found the welcome of spirituality through their faith and have in their own way discovered the parallels. Excellent. Very fortunate people. Or through profound commitment to another person, a partner, a wife. Experience of being a parent. Or the experience of burying a good friend or a child or partner. Life is what it is. It's an interesting classroom. Interesting classroom. Interesting experience. When things do not work out the way that we intend, Freemasons are taught that new opportunity appears right in front of us if we choose to look for it. Why the grumpiness? Why the discord? Things move sideways as much as they move forward. But I don't see the leaves falling off the trees straight to the ground. I don't see the raindrops falling out of the sky straight to the ground. I don't see lightning in a line, a straight line. No. I don't see a current of water just in a straight, moving in a straight line. Everything moves around, influenced by different forces, different currents. Remember, I think human beings often believe that we're an unfinished project, an incomplete project that walks around with this notion that we're complete. If we're stuck because of something in the past, then we're stuck because that's the completeness of us. But it's a mistaken belief. We're never finished. We always have that point of renewal right with us. It's a wonderful state. Now, let's move on a little bit. Alchemists, join me. It is in itself a metaphor. Some really, I think we can say, it doesn't mean that when people are really brilliant that they always make sense or that we should follow them, but I tend when we're looking through history, those are the people that whose ideas seem to have bubbled to the surface, you know, time and time again. Here, listen, check this one. This is some knowledge from a fellow that lived in the 15th century. A well-spent day brings happy sleep. I'll tell you in a minute who's saying this. Nothing strengthens authority so much as silence. Just putting up with it. It's a dangerous practice. It destabilizes organizations. I love those who can smile in trouble, he said, who can gather strength from distress and grow brave by reflection. It is the business of little minds to shrink, but they whose heart is firm, whose conscience approves their conduct, will pursue their principles unto death. The greatest deception men suffer is from their own opinions. It's a little harsh, but a little close to the bone, wouldn't you say? While I thought that I was learning how to live, I have been learning how to die. This man would make an incredibly interesting Freemason. Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. There are three classes of people, he goes on. Those who see when they are shown, than those who do not see. Time stays long enough for anyone who will use it. Human subtlety will never devise an invention more beautiful, more simple, or more direct than does nature because of her inventions. Nothing is lacking and nothing is superfluous. In rivers, the water that you touch is the last of what has passed and the first of what of that which comes. So with the present time. He who loves practice without theory is like the sailor who boards ship without a rudder and compass and never knows where he may cast. Where there is shouting, there is no true knowledge. This guy was born on the 15th of April, 1452. And he's referred to today as an Italian Renaissance polymath. He's a painter, sculptor, architect, musician, mathematician, engineer, inventor, anatomist, geologist, cartographer, botanist, and a writer. His genius, perhaps more than that of any other figure, epitomized the Renaissance humanist ideal. It's where we started to think that, you know, up to then, the creator was considered, all of our thoughts had to be about that creator, and now, all of a sudden during the Renaissance, the thought was about us in relation to, about the human experience in relation to all these influences, factors. He's been described as the architect of the Renaissance man. You have an idea who it is? He was primarily renowned as a painter. He was born, his parents weren't married. Father was named Piero da Vinci, and a peasant woman, Caterina, in Vinci, in the region of Florence. He got around, he worked in Milan, Rome, and Bologna, and Venice. He spent his last years in France at the home awarded to him by King Francis I, the Mona Lisa, Last Supper, Creation of Adam, Leonardo's drawing of the Vitruvian Man. These few works, together with his notebooks, which contained drawings and scientific diagrams and his thoughts on nature of painting, are all that's left, all that tells us about this incredible person. Leonardo da Vinci. I think we'd like to sit across from him in lodge, yeah? But I wonder if he would be bored. Wonder what we would do to engage this this mind. Probably treat him with great authenticity and genuineness and sincerity. The things that connect all of us together. Interesting quotes, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Remember talking about a list of under masonry defined, under landmarks. Remember having those defined? And we went through them. And there really are things that are out of history that we have come to think of as part of the order. Now, is there a rightness or wrongness with what history has given to us? Well, there's probably been influences along the way, small things that influenced that whole process. Probably not a cause and effect. You know, this happened, therefore that's a landmark. Probably been small occasions and meetings and discussions, but over the course of time, these little pearls were carried forward. And it seems that over the passage of time, there's a cleansing. We don't tend to keep silly ideas in front of us. We tend to pass on really good ideas. Here our friend Johnson talks to us about the foundation of a speculative science. Foundation of a speculative science upon an operative art and the symbolic use and explanation of the terms of that art for the purpose of religious or moral teaching constitute another landmark of the order. The Temple of Solomon was the symbolic cradle of the institution, and therefore the reference to the operative masonry which constructed that magnificent edifice to the materials and implements which were employed in its construction, and to the artists who were engaged in the building, are all competent and essential parts of the body of Freemasonry, which could not be subtracted from it without an entire destruction of the whole identity of the order. Hence, all the comparatively modern rites of Masonry, however they may differ in other respects, religiously preserve this temple history. And these operative elements as the substratum of all the modifications of the Masonic system. The last and crowning landmark, Johnson proclaims, number 25, is that these landmarks can never be changed. Really. Nothing can be subtracted from them. Nothing can be added to them. Not the slightest modification can be made in them. As they were received from our predecessors, we are bound by the most solemn obligations of duty to transmit them to our successors. I get it. We pass on the information intact for each subsequent generation to reflect in its own way, never claiming that our translation or interpretation is better than what would come in the future, or what was in the past. The past, the translation in use in the past was pertinent to that time and relevant to it. The way we use it is the same. And if we tinker with it, we're never sure whether people will be translating or digesting the our modification. But I would like to, if I could sit with Johnson, speak with him about the changes that occur in the meaning of our language, the words and phrasing. The way we use our language today is not the same as it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago or three. It's not right or wrong, it's just the vernacular. Day by day, men and women talk, and the means, there's always new words coming up, being created, and other words that fall out of use and favor. So if we were to remain rigid, and I don't think that's what Johnson's saying, he's saying unchanged. Don't change the meaning is what I hear him saying. It's not the words, but it's the meaning. So preserve the meaning and pass that on. Is that a little too, you decide. Is it the wording? Are we literalists? We see the same wording and then we reflect on that. Even though the words used to describe things have new meaning in our contemporary setting. I'll talk to you about that. We'll come back to that. I think that's... He also gets into late hours. Well, just like the district deputy did, censoring lodges for keeping young entertainers waiting until 11 or 12 o'clock. Oh, dear. We have a different attitude toward the time. Today, you open lodge, you finish 9:30, 10 o'clock. You'd be wrapping up. You'd be allowing the boys to step out of lodge and to talk. have a sip of something before they head home, a sip of water or a cup of coffee or tea, rather than everybody being subjected to, when they're anticipating the lodge door, you see it's really interesting to see when they're held there. And you know I'm not a big fan of the acts of persuasion, the marketplace, the ads that go on. At every meeting I've ever heard, there's been some type of ad, solicitation. Ticket sales, I think they belong there, but ticket sales for all kinds of what? Add-ons. Or solicitation of participation, as if that's how it's done, with that little tinge that if you don't participate, somehow you're guilty of an indiscretion as a Freemason. Interesting, isn't it? But, of course, I live in a Masonic world of experts. I'm always amazed at what I learn. He says here, late hours, it is a fact confirmed by experience that an indulgence in late hours cannot fail to injure the credit and respectability of a lodge, because it introduces other habits which are not consistent with the gravity and decorum which ought always to characterize the proceedings of Masonry. And hence, it is an important part of the proceedings of Masonry, an important part of the worshipful master's duty to discountenance such baleful practice. Not that, baleful practice. If the brethren meet for the purpose of business or to cultivate a knowledge of the science by joining in the lectures, let them pursue their labors with assiduity and zeal during the period prescribed in the bylaws. And should it be necessary for the junior warden to perform his office, let the brethren enjoy themselves with decent moderation. But by all means, let the senior warden discharge his duty honestly and conscientiously. Let the lodge be closed, and the brethren depart to their own homes at such an hour as shall excite no unpleasant feelings, nor call forth reproachful observations from the females of their families, whom it is their duty and interest, as well as in the character of husbands and fathers, as of Mason, to love, to cherish, and to oblige. Man. Thank you, Brother Johnson. Thank you. A little wisdom from the past, hey? We're going to change the step just a little bit. Just a little bit. I'm not trying to inject Masonic music back into things, just the idea of music. I'm not sure what Masonic music would be today, what the composers would be writing today. But that's not encouraged. It's not encouraged. Pianos sit out of tune. Here's a song by a very well-known performer. He's no longer with us.
I want a Sunday kind of love.
Etta James.
A love to last past Saturday night. And I'd like to know, it's more than love at first sight. And I want a Sunday kind of love. Oh, yeah. I want a love that's on the square. Can't seem to find somebody, someone to care. I'm on a lonely road that leads to nowhere. I need a Sunday kind of love. I Someone to enfold to keep me warm when Mondays and Tuesdays grow cold. Love for all my life to have and to hold. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, nothing but Sunday. Oh yeah, I want a Sunday, Sunday.
That's for Canada. A little song for the entire country. Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful music. And James. That's in a particular interesting kind of mindset, eh? I'm going to talk to you about a life-giving elixir. Sure, you can take that and get your notebooks out. I think you'll find this very helpful the next time you have been out after a night of debauchery and you've been struck down by fever and paralysis. I know that's quite common. Well, for those of you who are around in the 14th century, and I suspect some of you still remember, have fond remembrances of those times, and probably have kept you some of your kept some of your artifacts, your souvenirs. And on a winter night in 1386, the royal doctors were summoned to the bedchamber of Charles II of Navarre, or Navarre. And that's he was the ruler of a small kingdom up in northern Spain, and he was known as Charles the Bad. Oh, yeah. A nickname he earned early in his reign when he suppressed a revolt with particular cruelty and ferocity. His favorite pastime was plotting against his father-in-law, the King of France. That's a real crowd pleaser. Now, after a night of debauchery, Charles had been struck down by fever and paralysis, and his doctors decided to administer a medicine reputed to have miraculous healing powers and made using an almost magical process, the distillation of wine. One of the first Europeans to experiment with this novel process was the 12th century Italian alchemist Michael Salernes, who learned it from Arab texts. A mixture of pure and very strong wine with 3 parts salt distilled in the usual vessel produces a liquid which will flame up when set on fire, he wrote. Eventually, this process was known only to a few select at the time, since Salernes wrote several of the key words of his sentence, including wine and salt, in secret code. Since distilled wine could be set on fire, it was called aqua ardens, which means burning water. Of course, burning also described the unpleasant sensation produced in the throat after swallowing distilled wine. Yet those who tried drinking small quantities of aqua ardens found that this initial discomfort, sometimes disguised using herbs, was far outweighed by the sensation of invigoration and well-being that swiftly followed. Wine was widely used as a medicine, so it seemed only logical that concentrated and purified wine should have even greater healing powers. By the late 13th century, as universities and medical schools were flowering throughout Europe, distilled wine was becoming acclaimed in Latin medical treatises as a miraculous new medicine, aqua vitae, or water of life. One firm believer in the therapeutic power of distilled wine was Arnaldo Villanova, a professor at the French Medical School of Montpellier, who produced instructions for distilling wine around 1300. The true water of life will come over in precious drops, which, being rectified by three or four successive distillations, will afford the wonderful quintessence of wine, he wrote. We call it aqua vitae. And this name is remarkably suitable since it is really a water of immortality. It prolongs life, clears away ill humors, revives the heart, and maintains youth. Aqua vitae seems supernatural, and in a sense it was, for distilled wine has a far higher alcohol content than any drink that can be produced by natural fermentation. Even the hardiest yeast cannot tolerate an alcohol content greater than about 15%, which places a natural limit on the strength of fermented alcoholic drinks. Distillation allowed alchemists to circumvent this limit, which had prevailed since the discovery of fermentation thousands of years earlier. Arnold's pupil, Raymond Lully, declared aqua vitae an element newly revealed to men but hid from antiquity because the human race was then too young to need this beverage destined to revive the energies of modern decrepitude. Both men lived to be well over 70, an unusually advanced age for the time, which may have been taken as evidence for aqua vitae's life-prolonging power. This wonderful new medicine could either be administered as a drink or applied externally to the affected part of the body. Aqua vitae's proponents believed it could preserve youth, improve memory, treat diseases of the brain, nerves, and joints, revive the heart, calm toothache, cure blindness, speech defects, and paralysis, and even protect against the plague. It was, in short, regarded as a panacea, which is why Charles the Bad's doctors decided to administer it to their patient. Working by candlelight, they enveloped the king in sheets soaked with aqua vitae, hoping that contact with the magical fluid would cure his paralysis. But the treatment went disastrously wrong. The sheets were accidentally ignited by a careless servant's candle, and the king instantly went up in flames. His subjects are said to have regarded this fiery and agonizing death as a divine judgment, for one of the king's final acts had been to order a dramatic increase in taxation. Over the course of the 15th century, aqua vitae began to change from a medicinal drink into a recreational one known as knowledge of distillation spread. This process was helped by a new invention, the printing press, developed by Johannes Gutenberg during the 1430s. It was new to Europeans, at least, though the same idea had occurred to the Chinese some centuries earlier. The first printed book about distillation was written by Michael Pfuff von Schrick, an Austrian doctor, and published in Augsburg in 1478. It was so popular that 14 editions of the book had appeared by 1500. Among the claims made by von Schrick were that drinking half a spoon of aqua vitae every morning could ward off illnesses, and that pouring a little aqua vitae into the mouth of a dying person would give him or her the strength to speak one last time. But for most people, aqua vitae's appeal came not from supposed medicinal benefits, but from its power to intoxicate people quickly and easily. Oh. Distilled drinks proved particularly popular in the cooler climes of Northern Europe, where wine was scarce and expensive. By distilling beer, it was possible to make powerful alcoholic drinks with local ingredients for the very first time. The Gaelic for aquavite, euskabitha, is the origin of the modern word whiskey. This new drink quickly became part of the Irish lifestyle. One chronicler recorded the death in 1504 of Richard MacReidle, the son of an Irish chieftain who died after drinking water of life to excess, and it was water of death to Richard. Elsewhere in Europe, aquavite was called burnt wine, rendered in German as Bratwein, and in English as brandy wine, or simply brandy. People began distilling wine in their own homes and offering it for sale on feast days. The practice that was widespread and troublesome enough that it was explicitly banned in the city of Nuremberg in 1496. A local doctor observed, "In view of the fact that everyone at present has gotten into the habit of drinking aquavite, it is necessary to remember the quantity that one can permit oneself to drink, and learn to drink it according to one's capacities, if one wishes to behave like a gentleman." See the connections, little turns in that current. Look what you come up with. And did we hear it? Something about divine justice in that for a very, very unpleasant king. Well, history is what it is. It's not very kind, but and it judges us all, doesn't it? There's no question about it. Here's some. Let me come back. We're going to move on to another portion of the show. This is Tony Bennett, of course, and we're going to. We're going to have to listen to him sing The Way You Look Tonight, which is an odd tribute to the country. I know we call ships she, probably because of the feeling of the obligations sailors felt for their wives and girlfriends that they left behind many, many years when they were, you know, off for months and months. Not too uncommon for navies even today. You know, it's something we could do a whole program on. It's Freemasonry and the Navy. See what we come up with. It's an interesting time. We're going to play, here's a little bit of Tony Bennett. It's a little more nostalgic, a little more kickback, but I think I like it.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight. Oh, but you're lovely. With your smile so warm and your cheek so soft, there is nothing for me but to love you. Just the way you look tonight. Your tenderness grows, tearing my fear apart. And that laugh that wrinkles your nose, crosses my foolish heart. Lovely, never, never change. Keep that breathless charm. Won't you please arrange it? 'Cause I love you just the way you look tonight.
What's not to like? We're going to wrap up our show today with just a few little tidbits on the little bit of the history. A little more, not a whole lot, just a little more. Here you go, Canada. I hope you'll be out there committing acts of random Masonic kindness. The best being those that are not recognized or even acknowledged. Okay? It's a lovely time to be alive. I look forward to having you all come back. Little bit, work this into your conversation here, gentlemen. Regularity and recognition are very confusing issues, and I warn you right now, this topic may make you sort of nod off, so I'm going to finish up with a little tune by a Canadian that I think everybody will acknowledge is just most breathtaking kind of a voice that you can imagine. Masonic regularity.
Subway, eat fresh, looks great.
By the use of one Grand Lodge to describe another Grand Lodge and its members. Masonic regularity is determined by every single Grand Lodge according to its own rules and regulations. Yeah. So there you have it. It's not like a corporation or a worldwide entity. It's a reason, but no one owns the worldwide trademark of the square and compasses, the logo. Good Lord, how many times do we hear people talking about the square and compass, north, south, east, and west, or when they really are talking about compasses, an instrument for measurement? It would be like the Methodist Church claiming it holds universal rights to all trademarks and symbols and sacred texts of Christianity. We get enough of that kind of looseness. Grand Lodges can't stop a group of people from obtaining the Masonic ritual out of a book, buying a stack of aprons and officers' jewels, and claiming that they have their own Grand Lodge. Like branches of the Christian churches, there have been arguments and schisms between differing Masonic groups over the centuries, and factions of Masons that have started their own Grand Lodges. But to be recognized, you know, to be recognized, to be examined, to be accredited, I think is part of the perfection of what we are. I hope you have a beverage in your hand. You can close your eyes and be taken away by this. I look forward to having you join me again. Let's see, we're coming up to the annual communication, so we'll work around that. For those of you who tuned in last week and found that I wasn't there, I apologize profoundly. Sometimes I just can't get to the equipment, and it's no excuse. You deserve better. to reset appointments. But so is regularity, isn't it? Anyway, it's a pleasure having you join me. Thank you so very much for coming. We'll do this again soon.
What's the newest trend in deep?
Hate these things. You fellas take care of yourselves. I'll see you real soon. Cheers.